Welcome to your third class on the history of the First World War. I'm going to start off here with a short video. This man has 7 minutes. This gentleman does a series of YouTube videos about the First World War. And I thought it was interesting to look at, and I'll explain why afterwards. But he's now going to explain the most important things about the First World War in 7 minutes, okay? So, and this is entitled, in fact, the 10 major misconceptions, or the 10 mistakes, the 10 myths that people have in their heads about the First World War. I will look at them afterwards, yeah? Of course, it's also a matter of opinion. Please. No? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. C'est-il une autre ou non? Non. Mais entrez. J'ai vieilli tant que ça depuis la semaine dernière. Oh là là. Okay. Non, il faut toujours entrer en retard. Il est très très rare que j'exécute les retards. Okay, so we're going to first of all watch this film, which is about 7 minutes long. Are you ready?
There's been a lot more coverage of the Second World War than the First, as most of you are no doubt aware. And we've noticed that probably because of that lack of coverage, people have a lot of misconceptions about the First World War, how and where it happened, and who was fighting it. And we're going to try to fix that today. I'm Indy Nigel. Welcome to a Great War special episode, the top 10 popular misconceptions about the war. Number 10, Russia was only a second-grade military power in the First World War. Not true. Russia may have left the war after the Revolution, and certainly the Great Retreat and disasters like the Battle of Tannenberg don't exactly make the Russian military record shine. But the Russian army was anything but a pushover. At this time, 100 years ago, they were just romping through eastern Anatolia, and the Brusilov offensive and the innovative tactics it used came seriously close to knocking Austria out of the war, or even collapsing the entire Austro-Hungarian Empire. It certainly broke the back of their army. The enormous growth and modernization of the Russian military industry by 1916 was also nothing to sneeze at. Number 9. Everything has already been said about the war. No, new stuff is being discovered all the time. Like that Edith Cavell actually was spying for Britain. Or that Falkenhayn's claim that the Battle of Verdun was to bleed France to death is quite likely an invention after the fact. Files are being declassified even now, 100 years after the war. Who knows what we're going to find out. Number 8, the Germans were the bad guys in the war. Really? Since they were the bad guys in World War II, and wartime stories of the bloodthirsty Huns circulated in Allied media, they had to be the bad guys, right? And they got all the blame at Versailles in 1919. That has to count for something. Well, not so much. Was it Germany's fault that the whole house of cards came crashing down? That the war escalated into the horror that it did? Not so much more than anybody else in Europe, who all had outdated ideas about the necessity of the war and how to pursue it. And sure, you do have episodes like the Rape of Belgium, but atrocities were committed by all sides. The Armenian genocide and the massacres committed by the Russians in East Prussia in 1914 spring to mind. Just because somebody is the enemy doesn't mean that they're the bad guy. Sometimes there is no bad guy. Sometimes everyone is the bad guy. Number 7, the war in the skies was a gentleman's war. The flying aces, like the Red Baron and Billy Bishop, they were the rock stars of the war, gliding above the carnage and fighting man to man chivalrously. Except, again, not so much. They were fighting with machine guns, and they were most often flying in formations by the second half of the war, when the average life expectancy of the pilots could be measured in hours. And never forget, the perfect kill happened when the enemy never saw you coming. Number 6, World War I was a European war, not a world war. Not true. It had its origins in Europe, and there was certainly a lot of the fighting done in Europe, but, you know, once the Ottoman Empire joined, you should have a clue how it would spread. Even before that, Japan fought against Germany. The United States and Brazil would eventually join the war. There were battles in the South Pacific and the South Atlantic. Soldiers from every continent except Antarctica would fight. And of course, there was fighting all over Africa, mainly by the overlords. But there were fronts in Persia, Mesopotamia, Libya, and even the borders of India. Definitely a world war here. Number five, the war was only fought in the trenches. The trenches are the symbol of World War I, and while they appeared on pretty much every front, the vast trench networks were only really common on the Western Front. In the deserts or the huge open spaces of the Eastern Front, cavalry played a bigger role, and huge trench systems would have been most often impossible to maintain. Number four, tactics during the war didn't change. It's easy to think that, looking at the week-by-week carnage, how we cover it, but if you look at tactics in 1914 and those in 1918, it would be difficult to find many real similarities. The stalemate across the various fronts pretty much forced tactical innovation. Heck, the war saw the advent of mechanized mobile warfare, and certainly the techniques Hitler's Wehrmacht used at the beginning of World War II grew directly out of those used at the end of World War I. Number three, navies did not play a real part in World War I. Well, the biggest battle in naval history, the Battle of Jutland, happened in World War I. Britain's Atlantic blockade of Germany was a big factor in depriving Germany of supplies. There were countless naval skirmishes all over the war. Germany tried to turn the tide of war with unrestricted U-boat warfare. And if you look at the Mediterranean, the major powers there were using their navies to block each other. There were also great stories of German raiders like the Mauve or the Emden, which you should definitely check out there. Number two, the German army wasn't defeated in World War I. Yes, they were. They endured far longer than anyone could have imagined, and their final offensives in 1918 were real forces to be reckoned with. But the state of the army by the summer of 1918 was catastrophic in terms of supplies and morale. And the state of their allies was worse. Austria-Hungary never really recovered after 1916. The Ottoman Empire had huge problems even before the war, and the Bulgarian army collapsed. The German army did call for a ceasefire before the Allies broke through the Hindenburg Line, which they would have done. Number one, World War I was mainly fought on the Western Front. There was the Eastern Front, the Serbian Front, the Italian Front, the Salonika Front, Gallipoli, the Persian Front, the Mesopotamian Front, the Palestine Front, the Libyan Front, the Caucasus Front, the Romanian Front, East Africa, Southwest Africa, Cameroon, the War at Sea, the Arab Revolt. Did I miss anything? The Western Front was but a fraction, and not even a big fraction, of the total of the First World War. Okay, well, that is my list for now. Now, no doubt you have many things you disagree with or many others you'd like to add to the list. Please let us know in the comments. And for anyone new to our channel, you can find over 200 videos about World War I on our channel. But if you're a bit overwhelmed with the selection, you can check out our 101 video right here. Don't forget to subscribe. See you next time.
Okay, there you go. Now, that brings up a whole load of questions about what is history. And why you... May I continue? Thank you. About what is history and why you write history. Now, of course, one of the problems of writing history books is that people don't read them. You notice this, yeah. A lot of people don't read history books, you know. Do you go home in the evening and say, oh, yeah, must read a history book? Sometimes because you're obliged to by the university, yeah? Okay, so there are a whole series of tactics which historians use to try to bring people into history, and this obviously is one, the YouTube video, 7 minutes, okay, 7 minutes, yeah? Huh? It's got obvious advantages. Did you hear how many videos he has made?
2,000.
No, 200, I think. I think it was 200. Was it 2,000? No, I think it's 200. Yeah, which is still, it's still a huge number of videos. Yeah, 200 videos. Okay, so the YouTube video is one reaction to the question of history. There have been other ones as well. I don't know if any of you have heard of a novelist called Ken Follett. Ken Follett, who writes historical novels, which are bestsellers. He wrote one about the First World War called, what was it called? I can't remember what it was called. He wrote a series of three about the 20th century, Ken Follett. And first of all, he wrote one about the Middle Ages. It's called Les Piliers de la Terre, The Pillars of the Earth. It's about the building of the cathedral. But he wrote three about the 20th century, and they sold millions. My history book did not sell millions. So novels, sometimes seriously researched novels, are another option, okay? But here, this guy's going for the video. But he said a couple of more things about what history is or could be. First of all, he is seeing history in this video. This is military history. You know, we're not looking at any... I'm going to look at the other aspects, but we're still on military history. You know, that's the centre of his thing. Secondly, he talked about the archives. He said there are still secret documents that governments are opening today, which have been secret. And this is a big question of the archives. Yeah, when you find out something new, is it usually because you found a new archive? I suspect not. And the third thing that he did is that the whole title of his video is 10 Common Myths, 10 Common Misconceptions. What you think about history, which is not correct. And this is one popular way of doing history. In fact, there's a whole group of historians I will talk about later called the revisionists. They call themselves the revisionists. It's not linked to revisionism about the Second World War. It's no connection. Where they say that the job of the historian is to correct the mistakes that people have in their heads. This is one view of history. Whereas, as I've been saying, I've been defending a different view of history where the most interesting thing is to find new questions. Okay. Now, he's not trying to find new questions. He's trying to look for questions which people have already asked themselves but they haven't understood. Yeah. So he's not really looking for new questions or new sources. He's looking at how what the historians know has not got out to the general public. So that's one particular view of how history works. There are many more, because of course the historian has two jobs really. Number one, in theory, is to find out interesting truths about the past. But number two is to communicate them. Because if I write a letter to my mother with the results of my research, that's very nice. But you know, it's not quite history until you communicate it. And you could communicate it. Well, I can write an article in the Journal of First World War Studies. Not a lot of people read it. Yeah. So the second question is how to get it out to people if you think it's important. So that was just I'm going to look for some more videos, but always looking at this question of what do historians do? Why do they do it? How useful is it? And the other side of this, of course, is one of the places that you meet history all the time. Is education. When you go to school, you do history. And it's almost every education system in the world says children must learn history. Which is very interesting, because if you take some other questions, like in France, you learn philosophy at the lycée. In England, you do not. Huh? In some cases, when I was young, I learned Latin at school. Probably some of you did not, and certainly the young people in England do not. So, but nevertheless, history, it seems that everybody agrees that children should learn history, but not everybody agrees on what history they should learn and why they should learn it. In fact, what history they should learn is generally a bit of a fight, quite a fight about it. You know, sometimes, well, often a political fight. Should they learn more French history, or should they learn French history and African history and Chinese history? Or a little bit of one, you know. And this is often political. It's not always political, but it's often political. It's about, you know, what is important, what is national identity, etc. And sometimes it's very easy to go, well, yes, you know, if you learn history, you get national identity. Do you? Where is it? Yeah. Sometimes the debate is very much simplified. It's just very, very much simplified, and the people fight about it. Yeah, you know, communist, fascist, etc. You know, which is, you know. Now, I know that a lot of you are... maybe not interested in this, but you should be, because you are... How many people are on meth? Yeah? And so you will... lots of people. So you will discover in schools that sometimes in your English manual there are bits of history, and occasionally history teacher might want to work with you on common projects, and so I just wanted to mention this thing which is coming up, which you may have been told about. Where's the program gone? I think it's there. No, it's not. It's the other one. That in November, they might be telling you about this. I'm sure they will be telling you about this. That there is a special thingy. Have you been told about this yet? You will be. There are 2 days, mostly for teachers, history teachers and German teachers and English teachers, about the question of Le regard de l'autre, mémoire et image de la Première Guerre mondiale, tout est en français. Vous n'avez pas besoin de voir tout ça. C'est simplement that it looks at the. I tried to find the program. It looks at the question of images of the First World War at the time, and also, most importantly, the question of how it is possible to use these in schools, working together with the English teacher, the German teacher, and the history teacher. Yeah, that's the idea. And now I can't find the program. There you go. The first part is a journée d'étude on the 6th of November, and there you have the whole lot of the things, yeah, les dessinateurs satiriques. And you are invited to come to this if you're free. Yeah, you're invited to come to this. In particular, at 16:50, there is an extremely 15:40, there is an extremely excellent speaker that I highly recommend, which is me. Okay, I just wanted to mention that's coming up. You can find it on the web. Otherwise, that's coming up. If you're interested in that, it's not obligatory. And now I'm going to go back to kinds of history. So I have to go back to teach World War One. Yeah, I'm going to go back to kinds of history, having more or less covered the ideas of military history and its changing aspect, how little by little it became, first of all, more international, talking about different parts of the world that had been less studied. Secondly, more democratic, in that instead of just asking the question, why did the Germans win this war, why did the Turks lose that war, you got more and more the question of what was the experience of the soldiers. And so these are different ideas, really, because how did the Germans win this battle and how did the French win this battle are questions connected with military strategy, military tactics, which, you know, people can be interested in abstractly or because they want to win the next war. Yeah, there can be a practical use for it. Whereas questions about what is the soldier's experience are more emotional questions. And they're more, and they suggest something else about what history might be for. That history might be about feeling connected with the people in the past. Just in the way that, you know, when we go, when we do tourism, I know you don't have any money to do tourism yet, but you will do later. When we do tourism, we quite like to understand, you know, if we go to Turkey, to Istanbul, for example, we quite like to understand something about how those local people see their lives, what kind of things do they eat, how do they work that's differently, what are the games they play which are not the same. We like that. I think this is because we like to feel a link with other human beings elsewhere, and I suspect that a lot of the interest of history is about feeling that link with elsewhere. Just as when you're studying astronomy or the Big Bang and so on, then it's partly about feeling in touch with the origins of our planet and the origins of our solar system. That's my opinion on it. So, got right through military history, including military history from below, oral history, diaries, and so on. And now we're going to move on to the next kind. I think perhaps you remember there were three kinds, three fields of history, trois configurations. When a new one comes along, it doesn't replace the old one, but it is additional to it. And the second field here is social history. So from the late 1950s, early 1960s, little by little, the people writing about World War One, especially in the universities, wrote more and more social history and rather less military history. There was still plenty of people writing military history, even if only because military history has money. The army will pay you to write books about the First World War, literally. through the universities. They have, you know, funds and so on, you know. And so social history. So the question about social history is, what is it? Why did it arrive? Why did people suddenly start it writing it? What are the main questions it is asking? Now, afterwards, of course, you may be interested or not interested. That's your choice, but you want to understand what it is. But first of all, yes, let's just do that one more time. It's my favourite bit of the class. So, definition of social history. Huh. Would anybody like to dare to try to define social history? Well, it's history which is social. It goes to parties and they go to the cinema. Would you like to have a go? Social history? What kind of question? You really wouldn't like to have a go. You haven't, yeah? Yeah. Anybody like to have a go? What kind of questions would social history ask? Anybody have half an idea? Oh, well, I understand you, but you're just a little intimidated. That's okay. Well, let's have a look at the dictionary, shall we, first? Now, the dictionary is never the end of the story, but it's the beginning of the story. Social history, there we have two definitions. I will read them to you in a moment. Yes, I will read them in a moment. Two definitions. Which one is the one we're looking for here? Is it number one or number two? Yeah, it's number one. Number two is something completely different about psychological and social work. So, the history of society or of social behaviour. First definition. The history of society or of social behaviour. So that's obviously moving away from military history. You have the history of the effect of armed force, so it's much more specific. The history of society, it's very big, isn't it? Society, what is society? It's enormous, it's things that people do all the time. Or of social behaviour, so I think social behaviour is anything you do because of the group you come from. And the second definition, which is the parallel definition, history with an emphasis on social structures. Yeah, so what is interesting? Social structures. Can you name any social structures? School. Your school is definitely a social structure. It's something that when they arrive, when finally the extraterrestrials arrive from Mars, they'll look at the school and say, what? WTF? Yeah, what is that? Yeah, what on Mars is that? Yeah, it may be a very good idea or a very bad idea, but it's a very social idea. The family. Families are completely different in different societies. If you go back 500 years in France, the family is completely different, you know. If you go back 500 years in France, you say, oh, I want to marry somebody who I love. What? It was a completely stupid idea 500 years ago, but whereas we often do this today, which is good, I think. You see? History with emphasis on social structures, the family, the trade union, the workplace, the factory, the university, these are all social structures. And what you can do with them. So that's what we're having. And apparently, this expression was first used in the early 19th century in the Gentleman's Magazine. Very, very nice. So let's have a look then at social history. Now, that's the beginning of a definition. You've never quite finished defining it. I looked that many years ago in 1985 there was a special issue of History Today, which is it's kind of like L'Histoire. It's a history magazine, but it's one you can find in the railway station. Yeah, so it's not just for universities. And this is what they put in their introduction. What is social history? So they had a whole issue, 50 pages, 100 pages, 50, 60 pages. What is social history? So obviously the question is not easy if you need a 50-page magazine about it. You know, you don't have a 50-page magazine, what is a banana? Because it's simpler than that. So here are some of the suggestions here. What is social history? Is it a new form of antiquarianism? Is it celebrating experience at the expense of analysis? Is it the sort of history socialists write? Is it rescuing the past from the enormous condescension of posterity? Is it mobilizing popular enthusiasm? What is social history? Seven historians' answers. Those are quite a good. First of all, if you have seven answers, my God, yeah, it must be quite complicated. Yeah. Just let me remind you, when I get to the end of my PowerPoint, it will go on the blog, yeah? So if you don't get every word, that's okay. Yeah, because I know it's hard to get it all. Although I always take photographs of them as well. So let's have a look at these suggestions, which are, we can imagine, they all have a little bit of truth in them. The first one, a new form of antiquarianism. Now, you probably have somebody in your family who is a bit of an antiquarian. That is, people who like objects from the past and detailed information about objects from the past. Do you anybody have anybody like that in your family? What kind of things? Furniture or furniture? Yeah. Oh, this one is not from 1833. It's from 1832. I can tell. Yeah. And there are many people who are like this about the First World War. So here I have a German helmet. Somebody told me it was from the north of Germany, but it's not. It's from the south of Germany. Look here, yeah, the detail. So antiquarians are interested in the detail, in particular of past material culture objects. Now, historians are generally a little bit sniffy about antiquarians because it's a lot of emphasis on detail and little emphasis on analysis. Yeah. Now, I think, you know, people are allowed to be what they have. So you know, what we get from this sentence here is the suggestion that, you know, military historians might say, oh, well, you know, it's just really antiquarianism, details about people's lives. And the same thing of experience at the expense of analysis, yeah, that history can be very, very analytical. You know, the alliances and the rise of industry in Germany and the economic competition with Britain. Whereas social history often looks at people's experience. And this has generally been a victory of social history. If you go to London and you go, despite its name, you go to the Imperial War Museum, which is much more interesting than the name appears to be. They recently completely changed. They have a huge section, of course, on the First World War, and they recently completely changed it. And the main change was much more talking about people's experience. You know, the experience is the big winner. In museums around the world, feeling what people's empathy with people's experience is a rising value. And I think also in school books. If you look at the school books that you see in your school, the history books that you see in the schools today, and you compare them with the ones when I went to school, the last century, yeah, okay, then they're very different. I mean, when I was at school, I learned that Napoleon did 7 good things and 4 bad things. I'm not really exaggerating. Yeah, they give us numbers, how many good things he did, how many bad things he did. The only thing I can remember is apparently the civil code was a good thing. Well, I know because I was told in school that I can't remember the bad things he did. He must have done something bad. Oh, he defeated Britain at one point. That's pretty bad. Okay. So, is social history the sort of history socialists write? Yeah? Do you have to be left-wing to write social history? It's an interesting question. It's true that there is a tendency for social historians to be left-wing, a tendency. But is it necessary? I don't know, but maybe we'll find out in this magazine. Rescuing the past from the enormous condescension of posterity. Now, this is a quotation from a great British historian, E.P. Thompson, who says that one of the problems we have is that when we look at people in the past, we think they're stupid. Yeah. So, you know, his example was people in the past who believed in magic. Yeah, and so, well, they believed in magic. How stupid was that? Whereas he said, if you look at what their lives were and what their problems were, you would not be so condescending. And secondly, he said, if you wait 100 years, people will consider a lot of the things you do as pretty stupid too. You know, I mean, look at rock and roll. That was pretty stupid, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, wait a while till you're old. You will see that. And finally, mobilizing popular enthusiasm. Do we need to write social history because it will interest people more? You can make television programs about social history. You can make television programs about military history as well. But it may be that social history will get more people involved. So let's see what kind of social history was written about the First World War. But first of all, I wanted to say a word about why in the universities there was more social history in the 60s. Well, it's very simple. As you know, in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, this was what you call in French the Trente Glorieuses, or what we call in English the Great Boom. And the Great Boom was lots of new industries, new car factories, washing machine factories, steel factories, plastics, etc. Enormous. And of course, and the factories got bigger and bigger, and motorways and housing got bigger and better. And for these new factories and new motorways, they needed not just workers, but also engineers, lawyers, accountants, and so on. And so they built a lot of universities. The number of people going to university went right up there. If I just do a little test here, how many people have a grandfather or grandmother who went to university? Okay, couple, okay. How many people have a father or a mother who went to university? More? Yeah, and you're all here at university, so the number of people is up. That wasn't hard. It works every time. That wasn't hard. That is to say that in the 1930s, when the military historians were starting, most historians came from elite families. Because if you go to university, that was the case. In the 60s, you got more and more people who had ordinary working class parents going into university, and so it would be not surprising that they wanted to ask questions about ordinary people. Yeah. So that was one of the things. Another factor was that in the 60s and the beginning of the 70s, Marxism was very influential in British universities, and indeed in French universities. It's funny because British people still think today that French universities are full of Marxist professors, which they are not. But they really say it's the reputation of 68, you know, the British, oh yeah, it must be like that still now, of course not. So obviously the influence of Marxism, which lasted for 20, 30 years, that led to people studying more than working people, ordinary people, and so on. So here are some of the kinds of books which have been produced. Not all of these are produced in universities, but I think that the universities have no influence anyway. Here is our old friend Richard Van Emden working with somebody else on oral history, an oral history of life in Britain during the First World War. So the people talking to them are not soldiers. There are people who stayed, who were not soldiers, who were in Britain during the war. The soldiers were in Egypt or France mostly, and very often did not come back very much. The amount of leave they had, the amount of holidays the soldiers had, was extremely small. It was like, you know, 2 weeks every year or every 2 years. Very, 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 very small. So an oral history of life in Britain during the First World War, all quiet on the home front. Another one there, home front, 1914-1918. Ian Beckett, How Britain Survived the Great War. And of course, one of the first things that all the historians notice and remark upon in the First World War in Britain is the new roles for women. Yeah, these are women working in agriculture in a way. I think they're working in agriculture, maybe they're not. But the kind of work that they normally wouldn't do before. Yeah, this would be men's work. And that was a huge difference there. Now, both of these use the expression home front, as you say in French, front intérieur, but that is not really a neutral expression. If you talk about Britain as the home front, it suggests that the whole of social life was organized in order to win the war. Yeah, because it's a front, a military concept. So you have the front in France and the Western Front and the home front. And the whole concept is built about the war. However, as we saw last week with trench warfare, very often people had other priorities than winning the war. That they didn't want to lose the war. They would prefer the war to be won, but they still had other things to do, which might be, you know, that a lot of people made a lot of money in the war. A lot of companies made a lot of money. I saw an advert in a newspaper quite recently for bulletproof jackets, the Gilet de pare-balles, which a company in Britain produced in 1916 and sold to the families. Yeah, buy this for your son and send it to him. Yeah, it's not an army. The army didn't provide, bulletproof things. It was a private thing. They were just making money. Yeah. Yeah, people always like to make money. But not everybody, but there's always people who like to make money anyway. Or people might want to, I don't know, do other things, sing or fall in love or whatever. You know, they weren't always thinking about the war. In fact, at the beginning of the war, even the government did not understand that it was a total war. In fact, the slogan of the government at the beginning of the war was business as usual. Yeah. And it's after about a year and a half they realized, oh, yes, we have a blockade here. Nothing is going to happen unless it becomes a total war. That is, that all of the economy was subordinated to the war. So after the first couple of years, the government started, it became really extremely centralized. So the government said, right, you're a company, you're a boss, you have a company, it makes chairs. Don't make any more chairs, make uniforms for soldiers. The government ordered companies what they must do. And so very, very centralized. But only after a year or two, because at the beginning of the war, nobody understood what kind of war it was. They had to discover little by little, yeah, as is often the case. Yeah. So home front. And so a more recent book, the home front of the Great War. That obviously seems to be the favorite subject. One more? Yes, a more recent book by de Kroot, very, very good book, doesn't use the expression home front, and I quite like that, and they don't use the expression home front. And he calls it blighty. Now, blighty is a slang, originally a soldier's slang word, which came from the British Army in India. The British Army was in India in 1700 and 1800 and 1850, hundreds of years, and they absorbed a few words from Indian languages, I don't know which ones, and blighty means England. Yeah, blighty means England, which reminds me, could you just all sign in? So I know who's here. So the first thing, just general histories of what happened in Britain during the war, which includes all sorts of interesting questions. You know, what happened to the men who tried to avoid going to war? All the different ways that they tried to avoid going to war. Because, of course, you know, a lot of people didn't want to. There are books, this is a 2014, these are 2014 books about workers during the war, so this is definitely social history, we're looking at them as workers, not as the Lancashire Regiment of Soldiers, military history. This is obviously social history, and obviously we'll necessarily talk a lot about women. On the right then, this book about British industry, and on the left a more specific book, Britain's railway companies workers during the war. It's so much more specific. And of course, you could write 1,000 books, you know, butchers during the war, cricketers during the war. There's a lot left to do. They may not all be necessary, because if you've read the book about butchers during the war and bakers during the war, do you really need to read the book about grocers during the war? Is their life so different? Yeah, they're all small shops. But there's a market for it. And this is interesting here, because you see that it's written about railway company workers, but it has a foreword by Michael Portillo, Conservative minister, government minister, and an introduction by a general of the army, who probably was not a railway worker, if it was a general. Huh? And so there's a certain prestige that can be had in social history. However, there is one aspect of social history, one category of social history, which is extremely popular, is local history. And there are hundreds of books about a particular town during the First World War. This also exists in France. You can buy in Rouen pendant la Première Guerre mondiale, or Sotteville, or even smaller places. So Bradford in the Great War, and again here you would tend to have stories which talk a lot about people's experience, and it's a lot of the connection is about empathy. And obviously you're intending to sell most of your books to people who live in Bradford, or people whose parents used to live in Bradford. There's something else interesting about this particular book, and that is that it is put together by the Bradford World War I group, so it's a collective work. And there are It would not be unusual in a local library to have a group who got together to write a book about the First World War in their particular town. There are a lot of them. Dover and Folkestone during the Great War. Newmarket Local History Society, the Great War. Of course, you don't have to write a book. You can, these days, you can establish a website instead of writing a book. Yeah, it's cheaper. You need some young person who understands the internet, but that does exist. So you get the arrival of the internet about 15 years ago transformed popular history, because it made things possible which were not possible before. I was looking at something very recently, a Twitter account by a New Zealand soldier, by a First World War soldier from New Zealand, saying every day what he did exactly 100 years ago today. So every day there are tweets during the day corresponding to his experience 100 years ago. Of course, it's not really by a First World War soldier. They're pretending. But it's a very original, completely new way of producing history through Twitter. And you've seen things like this. I also saw somebody planning to do Nelson Mandela. It was 50 years later. And they wanted to set up a Twitter account as Nelson Mandela and tweet every day as pretending it was 50 years ago, you know, in prison and fighting and so on. The aim is to get to a new audience who don't necessarily want to read history books. And it can be, I think it could be, it had a certain, they have a name for this. I was at the Association of American Historians conference in January, and they had a meeting for Twitter historians. Les historiens sur Twitter, the Twitter historians. That was a big thing. So lots of that's not specifically just about social history, but the new ways of doing history. Hove is another town. Hove and the Great War. It's near Brighton. A second area which has produced a lot of books is social history about women. I say a lot of books, I will correct that, which has produced a few books. There is still a massive lack of books about the First World War and women. And bizarrely enough, there are more books about women novelists during the First World War than about just women workers during the First World War. I think it may be because the literary departments are full of women wanting to write about that period, whereas the history departments are full of men. I don't know, that's just a guess. So there still is a tremendous lack of books, but there are some. Women Workers in the First World War by Gail Braeburn is probably the most attractive of covers. There it is again. This is a mix between social history and military history. The Roses of No Man's Land are the nurses who work in France. And this is by Lynn MacDonald, who's one of the major women military history writers. But this is kind of military, kind of social history. And there's a sign. How do you know that this was a successful book? This was a successful book. How do you know? Édité en poche. Now, when you have a history book, you know, if it gets to livre de poche, that means a lot of people are reading it, you know. This is the pelican symbol, and it's very cheap. And your book is cheap if it sells a lot. Otherwise, it's expensive, yeah. Tremendously expensive. Now, The Roses of No Man's Land did a fascinating social history of nurses, and there were all sorts of interesting things that come up in this book. One of them, for example, is that many of the nurses who went to look after the soldiers were volunteers. They were not paid. You know, they went as volunteers. Now, what kind of women would go as volunteers to France to work as nurses? Say again? Generally not married women, yeah, because married women would be expected to care for their husbands and so on. Yeah, so generally unmarried women. Otherwise, women with money or women without money? Women. Yeah, women with money. If it's volunteer, Yeah, the working class women had to work in the factories to feed their children. Yeah, so it was more wealthy women volunteers tended to go to be nurses, and they discovered something rather unusual, is that they arrived as volunteers, but the professional nurses were the bosses. Yeah, and the professional nurses were working class. And so suddenly, the wealthy woman who had 5 servants at home and was used to having servants was suddenly having to obey orders from these working class nurses. And it caused a lot of interesting... people learnt a lot. And it got to very... that was one of the things. The other thing is that the whole society was terrified about what the nurses would do with the wounded soldiers. Yeah, it was a society which was even more than today terrified of sex, and the worst thing in the world was to imagine women from wealthy families doing things with working class women. This was ultra shocking. Yeah, and so they had very, very strict rules. Yeah, in fact, in some places, if a soldier called you by your first name, you lost your job. Because you were being too close to the soldiers. So really, this is a c'est un autre monde. It was very, very close. And of course, people are very imaginative and sometimes manage to break the rules. But the rules were very, very rigid. Yeah, there was no socialising. You certainly could not go and have a cup of tea with a soldier. Oh my God, it was the old days. This is another approach to women's history, because it's a particular case study. It's about 2 women, Elsie and Mary. They found their a lot of information about them. And these were very, very interesting women. Before the war, they went around, they loved motorbikes. You know, these are old motorbikes. And they went all around England on their motorbike. And that was their hobby, yeah. And when they began the war, they wanted to help, so they wanted to be nurses, but the British Army were not interested, didn't want women. And so, in fact, they joined the Belgian Red Cross or something, and they had a lot of adventures, running their own ambulance. They had some money, and they bought their own ambulance, and they went to help. And I thought it was a very good example, because we always need to remember that there are always exceptions. Of course, in general, women 100 years ago did not have so many choices, followed much more strictly the rules, but there are always exceptions. And Elsie and Mary went around England in 1910 on their motorbike. You know, there are always exceptions, so there's always a variety. In fact, even the experience of women in towns could be very different from town to town. In some towns in Britain, 10% of married women went out to work. In other towns, 35%. Just in different towns, yeah, because of the different factories and so on. So I think we always need to be very careful not to say, oh, well, women 100 years ago were like that. Because there's always lots of exceptions around. That's a tremendously important thing there. Story of women helping the war effort is a long one. But certainly the hierarchy of society was extremely sexist. And we've seen in recent news in America that there's still plenty of sexism around, but you can't believe it. There was a story of a woman, a well-known woman, it's a well-documented story, who went to see the Minister of War and said, you know, what can we women do to help the war? And he replied, go home, madam, and sit still. Yeah, which is, of course, it is funny, but it's also extremely insulting. It's a really, really heavy sort of thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rentrez à la maison, madame, et tenez-vous tranquille. Il avait mérité de claques, mais c'est il y a un siècle, il les a pas eues. We're going to have a break for exactly 6 minutes. 20%.